People had requested that we discuss the mystical and practical sides of the idea of Shabbos, Shabbat. So let's see if we can try and understand something about the centrality of this idea. Not so much the halachic side of keeping the mitzvahs of Shabbos, but let's see if we can understand the background of the idea that we're supposed to have, the concept of such a night, of such a day. See if we can understand how it's linked to marriage. Mystically, it's linked very much to marriage. Some of that we won't be able to talk about exactly, except maybe in hints. The pleasure of Shabbos. It's linked to the process of birth. It's linked to the concept of the world that follows this one, the transcendent world. The many amazing mystical... There are no mystical sources that don't discuss the idea of Shabbos as a central idea. The problem is that we've been, as we've remarked before, I'm sure many of you have been here before, we've remarked before that the problem with our thinking is that we're taught to think in a non-spiritual way. That means we're used to thinking in a Western, secular, technological, Christian way, but not in a Jewish way. Which means that we find it very hard to think in abstraction. The spiritual pathway is a pathway of abstraction, of transcendence, what a person's trying to achieve by working on oneself spiritually. One is trying to achieve a level of transcendence where you lift yourself outside the body. A Western society focuses on the body entirely, virtually entirely, the pleasures of the body. Not much that's elevated much beyond it. So our thought patterns are not... We're not skilled in thinking in abstraction. What happens is when we try and get into thinking in abstraction, we end up thinking in pictures, which are worse than not thinking about the subject at all. That means we take an idea that's forbidden to think about in pictures or in words, and we think about it in graphic images or pictures. And so we end up with the most trife and un-Jewish and forbidden images. It would be much better not to think about the subject at all. That's the first problem. And the second problem is, and this is much more difficult to speak about, is that there are such misconceptions around about this particular idea about Shabbos, especially from certain Jewish quarters, that we'll try not to name, that have, let's say, reformed the idea of how Shabbos should be understood, even though they may claim to be conservative about it, but they not. The truth is that they've changed the idea into exactly its opposite. We're not here, again, to break down other people's beliefs. We're here to understand the essence of it. We have to understand where the difficulty lies. Let's see if we can try and explain this. Let's state the idea first and then see if we can track it down and work it out together. So the mystical idea is that Shabbos is a day when a person is supposed to celebrate what the mystics would call an endpoint. That means what they call tachlis. In other words, not easy to explain. Let's see if we can work it out. The most important thing that there is to explain, as you'll, I hope you'll see, it's got nothing to do with the day of rest. It's got everything to do with the day of rest, but not the way we think about it conventionally. Let's try and work it out. The idea in a nutshell is that what is being experienced on Shabbos, what a person is supposed to do for those 24 hours, approximately, is to experience the feeling of having arrived. That's what you're supposed to do. It's got nothing to do with whether you work hard or not. It's a bad misconception. People think that you have to rest on Shabbos. You don't have to rest on Shabbos. If you wish to carry your furniture around the house until you're exhausted, it's allowed. It's not exactly Shabbos dikkat. It's not the way that one would suggest spending Shabbos. There are better things to do. But it's not prohibited at all. It's got nothing to do with resting literally or physically. Person can exhaust himself on Shabbos if he wants to. And there may be side reasons why not to do that. But that's not against the essence of the day. The essence of the day is, quite apart from the idea of resting, is an idea where a person looks at themselves face to face, a very difficult experience, and you assess who you are. That means the end point that you've reached now, if your life, Chas v'Shalom, didn't continue now, like what are you worth right now? What have you done? Where's the work you put into yourself? Can you feel that? The remarkable idea. The mystics say that Shabbos is the happiest day that there could be. The highest day. The day of greatest transcendence. But if you don't do it correctly, it's the most depressing day that there is. There are sources that say that the early Christians, who were Jews, change Shabbos to a Sunday because it was too depressing. There are sources that say that. Because the day, when done correctly, has a tremendous potential for transcendence. But if not done correctly, it has a tremendous potential for depression, because it has an energy that a person can feel. And if a person doesn't ride the crest, doesn't ride the wave of that energy, what happens is you feel the power washing over you, and you feel that you're beaten down by it. People who are sensitive can actually feel this. Actually, the feeling begins sometime on Friday. There were mystics who said they could actually feel it as they got out of the mikvah on Friday morning even, midday. Some women can feel it when they light the candles. And it fades out sometime on Saturday night. There's special times, special things we do on Motzei Shabbos that are connected to transcendence between this world and another phase entirely. For example, it says that the food you eat on Motzei Shabbos, these things are very important, people don't know about them. The food you eat on Motzei Shabbos, what happens to the food that you eat? It's a special meal. There's a special meal called Malava Malka, which means accompanying the queen, just like we welcome the Shabbos queen in. King, the queen, in different Kabbalistic sources. We welcome the queen in with a special, with candles and with wine. So there's a special meal that we see the queen out with. That's called Malava Malka. It means to accompany the queen. And that meal, in mystical sources, it says that the food you eat then sustains a certain bone in your neck. Seventh vertebra in the bones of the neck. And that bone never disintegrates. That after a person is no longer alive, the resurrection begins from that bone. Good reason not to be cremated, by the way. Very important, halachic reason. And that is a special meal that takes the power of Shabbos and translates it into the rest of the week. That takes the energy that a person should have reached, should have realized on that day, and translates it into the next phase, which could be a tremendously depressing time. In fact, coming out of Shabbos could be so depressing, if you lived the high correctly, that we smell spices, because spices, Kabbalistically, are an idea that the brain, in fact, even medically it's known that the nerve that's connected most directly to the brain, from the nose to the brain, direct connection, is that the neshama itself enjoys. A smell is something that the closest physical sensation to the neshama itself. And therefore, you try and give the neshama an uplift when it feels depressed. But this uplift that you feel, it could be very depressing, this energy, this power, what is the power of this experience? So in a nutshell, the idea is that it's the experience of looking at yourself. You see that some of the world's activity is geared towards becoming as busy as possible on a weekend, so you don't have to face yourself. Yes, much of the world's activity is geared towards remaining busy during the week. You don't have to think about yourself. And then on Shabbos, on a weekend, let's say, when you have leisure time, it's a frightening experience for many people. They have to be alone with themselves. It's a terrible experience. At best, it's boring. And therefore, you see that the world has generated frenetic activity that involves the weekend, yes, that gets people into one way or another into unconsciousness, either alcoholic unconsciousness or into one or other form of unconsciousness to try and escape the discomfort of having to do nothing, right, and feel, because actually the experience of doing nothing, that meditation, actually is an experience of experiencing who you are. That's what it is. If you've spent the week building something, then the experience of an endpoint is very exciting. There could be nothing more exciting. It's the feeling of reaping the fruits of what you built. A very exciting feeling. You can feel that you built something this week, and you can feel that you're different than you were last week. If you enter Shabbos Friday night, and you feel a sensation that you're a different human being than you were last Friday night, it's a tremendously exciting feeling. But if you feel that you're the same, or you're no different, you haven't raised yourself, or maybe you're a little bit more tired, or a little bit more run down than you were last week, a tremendous sense of failure, because that's actually who you are. The busyness during the week is just, it's just a means to an end. Let's see if we can work it out. We'll try and discuss also, if we can, how the halachic application, what it is that you exactly do on Shabbos. What's all this got to do with not putting on a light, not striking a match? What's exactly that got to do with this idea of endpoint? Try and understand it. You'll see that in Torah, the halachic application, the halachic side, what you do technically in the physical world, always fits perfectly into what's happening in the spiritual world. On the contrary, they're exactly the same thing. It's by manipulating the physical in the correct way that you turn on the spiritual lights. The only way. The only way to do it. As we've discussed many times together, as the deeper sources always point out, the only way you can enter a relationship with another human being is through the body. Even though the body is a very lowly being, it's a very lowly creation, it's biological tissue that has only a finite lifespan, it's given to degeneration, carries its own excrement within it. It's a very lowly being, the body. It's not different than a monkey's, they're quite right about that. But inside, swirling around in some indefinite, intangible, ethereal motion, inside that physical meat that carries you around, inside is you, is the person. But the only way to engage that personality, that person inside, is through the body. You can't have a friend unless he has a piece of meat to carry him around in. You can't relate to him. You can't have children. You can't have friends. That means that the only way to access, if you like, the spiritual world is through the physical reality. So if you want to have a friend, you have to be able to move your hands, you have to be able to move your mouth, your face. You have to be able to operate a physical, tangible body in order to contact, to express the intangible neshama that's inside. And of course, they read your body. The person that you're relating to, they can't feel your neshama. They don't have an organ that picks it up. They never see you directly. The only way they feel you is they see the muscles of your mouth contorting themselves. They hear the sound waves vibrating. They see the actions that you do. No different than a monkey's. But they read them in such a way that they lose all sensitivity to the body and they concentrate only on what's happening. And that's the mystery of the world. Is that the whole world is a physical entity which is finite and limited. No matter how much you stare at a tree, you won't see the divine. You'll see a tree. It's being able to abstract from the physical. When you look at a human being's body, you won't see the divine. The more you look at the body, the more a person will look like a horse. That's in fact why we cover ourselves, so we don't look like a horse. We try to look a little different, just to block that. But the more you conceive, the more you look at the body, the more you'll be drawn into it. Only if you know how to switch into abstraction and not see it. That's what the meditation is. What they mean when you look at a tree and see Hashem, they mean you don't see the tree. That's what they mean. You see the switching into a higher dimension when you watch a person. The idea is not to see the body. The idea is to see the body just enough to train your eyes to see what's moving it. The remarkable thing about Shabbos is that the way you use the physical world, if you hear this well, the way you use the physical world on Shabbos to transcend into the spiritual world is you stop using the physical world. It's a remarkable thing. Let's understand this. Again, it's an idea of endpoint where you stop all activity. Mitzvahs, all mitzvahs that we do, with very few exceptions, I think you could count them on one hand probably, mitzvahs are done in the physical world. On one hand, maybe you could count the mitzvahs that you don't do in the physical world. Belief in Hashem, faith, fear of Hashem, certain things you have to remember. Very few things are done with the mind. Almost all mitzvahs you do with the body. You have to give something with your hand. You have to put your body in a sukkah. You have to... It's all physical. Why? Because again, the only access to spirituality is to take the vessel. In fact, the mystics say that that's the sadness. We'll try and discuss this in more detail. The sadness of the next world, the agony of the next world, is that you would love to do what's correct now, but you have no organs, you have no tools, you have no vessels. You don't have limbs to do that. You'd love to give something to somebody that you love and show them how much they mean to you, let's say, that you failed to do while you were alive, maybe. And you don't have a hand to do it. That's the agony. The clarity you have is much more than you had for a lifetime. But the potential to do it, you don't have anymore. That means you'd give anything up there for the lowliness of a finite, smelly piece of meat, the piece of steak that you once inhabited, that now you see to be so lowly, you'd give anything for that, because that's the only tool, the only access you have to spirituality, a remarkable paradox. So the spiritual pathway is that you take the physical tool and you use it. You use a hand correctly. Use every part of your body correctly. Use your brain correctly. Your mouth correctly. Your eyes, you look at what you're supposed to look at. Use every part of the body correctly to access spirituality. Shabbos, which is the ultimate mitzvah, that's the mitzvah you actually experience who you are in essence and not the process of becoming. You actually get in touch with it. The way you do it is you don't use anything. You stop using the physical world. You absolutely freeze within the physical world. Because you're not building anything. You're supposed to experience who you are, not what you are building. The rest of the week you work and work and work and build. But Shabbos you stop. Now it's remarkable, whenever the Torah speaks about Shabbos, it says 6 days shall you work, and then you rest on Shabbos. Stop on Shabbos. Rest, the English mistranslation, to call it rest, stop, whatever you want to call it. It's remarkable. It doesn't say that Shabbos is a day when you stop. It says first you work, and then the only way, it's a remarkable idea, the only way you can experience the spirituality and the serenity, the harmony, the beauty of Shabbos, is if you work for 6 days. If you do nothing for 6 days, Shabbos is terrible. The beauty of Shabbos, the appeal of it, the radiance that you feel on Shabbos, is if you work for 6 days. Work on yourself. Work hard. So that the seventh day, when you're not working on yourself, but you feel what you become. But if you didn't become anything for 6 days, so then it's terrifying to take a day off and feel that you haven't become anything. So the idea of Shabbos is the work that you do that leads up to it, and then the experience of suddenly snapping into a phase where you don't do anything at all, but you experience... That's the basic idea. Let's see if we can trace it now and work it out. Let's trace it this way. Let's start, not mystically, let's start logically. There are philosophical works that deal with it logically like this. They say the following thing. Let's stay together now. What justifies any process? Life is a process, right? It's a finite process. It goes very quickly. It goes very quickly. In fact, the older you get, the quicker the flash of memory seems to be. What is your past exactly? I don't want to get too depressing over here. But what exactly is your past? Those years, when you're 18, your past seems infinitely long. A year seems... But when you're 19, when you're 20, when you're 35, when you're 40, when you... So each time you consider the whole life that you've lived, the flash, the wisp of memory in your mind doesn't seem any longer. On the contrary, it seems shorter. And the older you get, the shorter it seems. So you have this process that's very, very ephemeral, very, very brief. What justifies any process? The end result. The end point. What justifies any process? Are we together? If there's no end point, I once heard a marshal, a beautiful thing. I once heard from a man, Gyanora, great Rosh Hashiva, is 91 years old today. He said the following thing. He said this. He said when he was young, I'd never seen this thing, but I heard from him. He said when he was young, there was a thing called an aviation clock. You know what that is? Don't blame me. There's a thing called an aviation. What it was, apparently, was they used to have near airports, or near the olden days flying fields, they used to have in the top room of a building, they used to have a clock, you follow, that operated on the top, on the roof of the building. That an aviator could look down, he could see the time. Yes? And the top floor of the building was mechanism. It was massive machinery that moved this clock, and had a shaft going up through the roof, and on the roof were hands that turned. That's what they had, apparently. It's no accident that he chose that for a marshal. You have to understand what it means, the wheels of time. But anyway, just fast, good enough just to understand the basic of it. Basic. What did he... She said this. Imagine if you walked into that room. You climbed the top of the building, you walked into that room and you saw this machinery. What would you understand? So you'd see a wheel that turns another wheel. That wheel moves a lever. The lever moves a spring. The spring moves another wheel. That moves another... And you trace it, right, as you go. If you never pass that, if you never trace your path to that shaft on the roof, the whole thing's pointless. Nothing could be sillier. You follow? Who would put all this effort into making one thing that does another thing that does another thing that doesn't get you any place? The justification for everything, no matter how complex it is, the justification is when you follow to an endpoint that makes sense out of everything. It's not that the endpoint makes sense. The endpoint makes sense and harmony and beauty out of everything that's got you to the endpoint. Let's translate it into modern terms. Now, let's say your friend was an inventor, and he one day calls you to see his new machine that he's invented. So you go and you watch this machine, and as he switches it on, that most incredible machine that does everything. It oils itself, it fuels itself, it services itself at the right time. It keeps it. What does it produce? Nothing. It just keeps itself going. Well, you'd think your friend is a fool. What's the point? What would be the point of producing a machine? That's a spectacular machine that needs no maintenance at all, that does its whole thing. If the machine makes you a pizza at the end of the day, yes, or it cooks you a cup of coffee, so then it's very clever, the fact that it maintains itself and keeps itself going. That makes sense. But it is not. Are we together? The whole thing's judged in terms of its endpoint. That's clear. Any process is judged, is justified by its endpoint. The only exception to that is a human being. That's the only exception. You and me. We are satisfied to live like a machine that chugs along, keeping itself going from day to day. For what? To keep going till the next day. For what? To keep going till the next day. How many people stop and ask themselves exactly what is it that I'm building? You laugh at your friend who made a machine like that, but your life doesn't bear any thought about where it's going? What are most people, let's understand, 99.9% of the world's population, what exactly are they busy doing? They're going to work today. What for? To make enough money, to eat enough food, to keep going to work the next day. Right? For what? Yes? So they can keep living, so they can go to work the next day. What for? For a few hours on the weekend where they collapse unconscious. Right? For the thing. And what's all that? Yes? So they can keep doing the same thing next week. And what's all that for? For 3 weeks at the end of the year when my mamish collapse unconscious on a beach someplace. Isn't that what it's all about? Until finally, there's some sort of vague notion that it will end someplace. There's a vague notion that they're right. It'll end, definitely will end someplace. But they sort of think it'll end someplace where maybe you'll have enough to sort of not have to do this anymore. But even if you're right about it, you'll be too old to do the kind of things you thought you would be doing by then. Isn't it ridiculous? That's what the world's engaged in. That's what the world's engaged in. I wouldn't spread this news around because it's actually much healthier for them to be doing this. Because when they do take a day off, they stab each other to death. That's what happens out there, yes? They drive each other into drive their vehicles into lampposts, and that's what happens. That's what happens in the world out there when a day is off. When the country declares a new day of a public holiday, it's a death warrant for thousands of people. So it's better that people who are not capable of generating the consciousness of an endpoint, it's better that they don't think about it. It's better that they keep working. So at least it keeps them occupied. But somebody who's trying to work out what he's here for, somebody's trying to work out what he's here for, you can't. It's a tremendous misery. That's a tremendous agony to think that you're working, to keep going, to keep working, to keep going. It's a tremendous, it's a terrible joke. That if it weren't that tragic, it would be very... So therefore, we understand that the most important thing a person could ever think about is what he's building. Why? Since you're spending your whole life doing it and there's so much agony involved. There's so much effort and there's so much agony. Even if you try to escape the pain, you can't escape the pain. You have to be very, even if you're lucky enough not to have personal pain, you have to be very, very insensitive not to feel other people's close to you. Who doesn't have somebody close to them, a tremendous suffering? So for sure it costs a lot. So you might as well have the goods. You're going to pay the price. You're here. You're here now and you're paying the price. You might as well have the goods that you're paying the price for. The goods are the end result where all this pain takes you. All this work, all this effort, the pleasure, the pain. But it gets you someplace. So it pays once in a while. Surely it pays once in a while to stop and think about where... I mean, this is all basic. I'm not telling you anything new. But I mean, the trouble is we don't do this. Unless you keep Shabbos. Shabbos, the idea is that it's once a week. You stop for a while and you think about exactly who you are. And exactly what you've achieved and where you're going. That's the idea. In fact, the remarkable thing about it is that Shabbos is called a Moed, which means a Yom Tov. It's a Yom Tov, like Pesach, like Sukkot, like Shavuos. But the difference is it comes once a week. So their commentaries say that all other times, every other Jewish festival, it's enough once a year. You need to learn about Freedom Pesach once a year. You need to learn about giving the Torah Shavuos once a year. But Shabbos seems that it's so important that you need this Yom Tov every week. Why is it so important that once a year is not enough? Because it's the ultimate importance. You can't afford to go for more than 7 days. There's mystical reasons also beyond this. But in practical terms, you can't afford to go for more than 6 days without re-entering a phase where you suddenly reassess whether you're still on track. I mean, this information is so... And nobody runs a business without having an assessment, a regular built-in assessment. Nobody does anything worthwhile in the world without a regular inbuilt assessment of whether the thing's functioning, whether the machine is achieving its objectives. It isn't off track. Shabbos is the internal assessment that you do. It's much more than this, but the first thing is that it's the internal assessment that you do that brings you home, and you sit down, you don't express yourself in the outside, you stop the building that you've been doing all week, and you focus inwards, unable to build, holding, desisting your hand from building on the outside, and you ask yourself what you become. And you make a goal for the next week, definitely. And by the next week you have to reassess whether you achieved that goal. That's, by the way, why some of the ideas in Shabbos, one of the ideas is a person should assess where he and his wife, let's say, relationship is holding, where the children especially. It's a unique custom that the Jewish family sits around the table on Shabbos and the children speak. You ask them, they have to say something, what they learned that week, what they learned in school, in cheder, Torah learning, what they became, and especially a mother's job. Especially a mother's job. There are certain sources point out that a woman is much more sensitive in terms of assessment of personality and where people are holding. And therefore, it's particularly the mother's input of judgment, exactly where the children are, what each child needs, what difficulties each child's going through, how the marriage, the relationships. The husband should listen to his wife about that. The many halachas that a woman is responsible for judgment of character. It says in some places that if a man brings a friend home whom his wife doesn't like, he shouldn't associate with that person anymore, even if she can't tell him why. But because she has a sensitivity to personality that a man doesn't have usually. You see it by Abraham and Sarah. Yes, by Abraham and Sarah, the children, he was wrong, he didn't understand Ishmael the way she did. And in the next generation, Rivka, Yitzhak and Rivka, he was wrong again. Yitzhak was wrong about Yaakov and Esau, and she was correct about it. They point out in every generation it was the woman who was the one, and that's what you do on Shabbos, you apply that wisdom, and as a family, you sit down and you focus on what is it that we're doing here. Where have we reached as an individual? You spread out that consciousness into the family. What exactly are we doing here as a family? You know how that could save a marriage? If a person waits too long until the crash has occurred, and you only start a post-mortem on the crash, that's not going to resurrect anything. But if a person could assess exactly what's happening each week and could stop the slide, and they could assess where they're going, where different values, let's say, have been created. You got on once, sometime. I mean, you fell for him or her, not once, seriously enough to actually commit the rest of your life to this person. So what happened on the way? What exactly happened on the way? So different values set in, maybe. So whatever it was, that became a difference between you. But maybe if you stop and assess it once a week, and you work out where this thing is going, I mean, that's a tachlis. In the next world, it says that a person and his wife, I don't know if you want to hear about this, in the next world, it says that a person and his wife are bonded into one. I mean, for some people that's good news, and for person married to a person's married to a very good wife, a very good spouse. It could be, in most cases, I can assure you that the benefit of being married to, especially for men, to a good woman. The truth is that women, I hate to admit this, but women usually live up to their obligations better than men. Usually, the problem with most marriages is men, unfortunately. The handle on correction of a marriage is a woman. The one who could fix it up is a woman. But anyway, that's another subject. But the point is that you bonded into one. Shabbos is a time to experience that, a special time of closeness between husband and wife, in terms of experiencing the closeness and in terms of assessing what it is that we're building together. Reb Chaim Sonnenfeld used to say, they once asked him, a very, very great tzaddik, a very righteous man, a book written about him called The Guardian of Jerusalem, it's very well worth reading. They used to ask him, when they asked him whether he had a share in the world to come, what was his share in the world to come? Such a righteous individual, they wanted him to describe. So he used to say that he sure has got a share in the world to come. Why? No, that's a very prideful statement. He said, because of the following reason. He for sure doesn't deserve it. But his wife is such a tzaddikus, she's such a righteous individual, she for sure does. And they'd never do it to her, yes, to put her there without him. So he's going to get in on her merits. And that's how he knew. So he said. So definitely you commit one. That's the first marriage. The second marriage works a little differently. There's a certain bond also over there. That's another subject. This is for another time. So you see that it's not just a practical mechanism for assessing, yes, where we're going and our happiness and our achievements together, but spiritually, it's actually an internalizing of the end point of what we've done. Let's try and understand. Let's go one level deeper. See, it's all saying the same thing at different levels. Let's see if we can try and explore it. If you look in certain sources, more hidden sources, let's say, they try to explain something like this. They say that everything is a process which is justified by its endpoint. The two phases of a process are the process and the endpoint. Which means this. Try to understand. The process is a thing that doesn't taste sweet. The process doesn't have fruits. The fruit is the fruit. Again, perhaps the best way to put it is in the analogies that the mystical sources use. They say that there's a tree and there's fruit. That's what they say. There's a tree. Life is a tree and then there's fruit. That's what they say. The fruit is in the next world. The tree grows here. The roots are here. And what happens is the fruit is experienced in the next world. That's the fruit. That's the result. What it means? It means you. You work for a lifetime on becoming what you should be becoming, on developing the sensitivity, the gentleness, the kindliness, the intelligence, everything that it is that you should be working on actively without taking a moment's break. You work on that for a lifetime, and what you experience in the next world is what you become forever. Forever, it's worth working on, because this goes in a flash, and that's forever. That means forever, whatever that means, forever, you live with a consciousness, just you. In fact, it says in many places that you're entirely alone, except for the idea of being bonded with one's husband or wife. In certain ways, a person's alone. Which means that you're focused. Again, relationships between families also preserved. But at one level, it means that you focus in on what it is that you've become. The happiness, and there's a pain also, as we expressed before. But the happiness of it is the feeling of the fruit that you've actually built. You planted this thing, you watered it, you nurtured it, you guarded it with your life, you worked on it your whole lifetime, and this is the fruit. Now, of course, you haven't missed the point that that's why the Torah says that Adam was created in a garden, and why the next world is called a garden also. Garden of Eden, it's called the garden. Eden means delights. The garden of Eden means the garden of pleasure. It means that. It means literally incredible ecstasy. That's what it means. The ecstasy of the fruit. That's how they describe it. Why a tree? First of all, you have to know Kabbalistically that the word for a tree is eitz in Hebrew. Eitz is the root of the Hebrew word that always means something intrinsic, like the word etzem. Etzem in Hebrew means actuality, or the bone of a thing, let's say. So eitz is something, again, the Torah is speaking at two levels. When you're 6 years old, it means that he was put in a garden with beautiful garden. And the next door is a place of trees. But when you're more mature, you have to understand it means a place of intrinsic, actual existence, not physical. Not as a physical component, but that's not the point. The point is it's a place where things are real. Here things aren't real. Here things are just the props that you need to play out your life to become real. But there things are real. So anybody who knows anything about anything deeper knows that it says that in the next world, the tree and the fruit taste the same. You aware of that? It says that the tree and the fruit, it also says, by the way, that cakes grow on the trees. That's what it says. That ready-baked cakes. Right? It says that, I said in Eretz Yisrael, that the the trees of Israel, but it means the higher land. That means they'll bring out baked cakes. What does it mean? Again, when you're 6 years old, it means a place of tremendous pleasure. It's, you know, there's fairy tales even about these things and children's songs about it. It's a child's delight. You know, the house is made out of cake and everything. There's a tremendous, those fairy tales, those rhymes, those nursery rhymes, they come from tremendously deep sources, not just a child's fantasy. But the concept behind it in level of abstraction, without getting trapped in the childhood version of physical reality, what it really means is this. What does it mean that the tree and the fruit taste the same? The understanding is like this. You see, when you live in a world of process, what happens is the process is not the fruit. You don't enjoy the process. Of course, if you spiritually evolve, then the process is also sweet. But that's another level. But basically, a person lives through suffering, let's say in this world, which is part of the process, the suffering doesn't taste sweet. Quite the contrary. What's it building? It's building something sweet. The next world, the tree and the fruit both taste the same. You can eat them both. What does it mean? It means you suddenly realize, in that dimension of actuality, of achievement, of endpoint, you suddenly realize that the tree is the fruit. You suddenly realize it's not that there was an experience that got you to this point. That experience is this point. Are we together? People think that the happiness of the next world is that the suffering's over. That's not the happiness of the next world. The happiness of the next world is not the fact that you're now over the phase of suffering. The happiness of the next world is that you now enjoy the suffering. Because you now realize that those difficulties... Let's give a crude example. When a person works at a sport, yes, there's a person spends 6 hours in the gym every day, trying to look like a gorilla, let's say. So that person, puts in tremendous effort. I mean, you should be healthy. My mum says so, yeah, but there's a limit. But a person, tremendous effort trying to build a certain... At the end of the day, what does he value? What does he appreciate? The pleasure, the ecstasy, what a person revels in, is the... You follow? It's the reward of all the work that he put in. It's not the fact that the work's over. The real happiness of work, never understand this, the real happiness of work being over, when the job's done, when the week's over, when you lock up, when the job's done, when you relax, the real happiness there is not the fact that you're free. You could have been free without having worked, and you wouldn't have felt this way. The enjoyment that you have is the fact that you're resting after having worked a hard job. The sweetness, you have to understand well, the sweetness of rest at the end of a hard job is the work itself that you put in. You don't feel that while you're doing the work. But afterwards, what happens if you're sensitive when you stop the work, what you enjoy, what you feel so intimately, and there's a whole side of intimacy here that we can't go into here, but what you suddenly realize is it's the work that's been building all the time, the effort that's gone in. That's what it means. In the next world, a person doesn't experience something different than this world. People think the next world is a place where you just have a wonderful time. It's completely different than this. The next world is a replay of this. But it's real form. It's a replay, that's what they say. You go through the whole thing again, but millions... Of course, that's the agony. Every time you hurt someone, every time you offended someone, you replay that. Millions upon millions upon millions of times. But this time you feel their pain. Millions of versions of that person sit and face you. And you go through the experience again and again and again. And each time you're trying to change it and you can't. You're trying to get it right and you go, of course you can't. Because you can't reform the words. You haven't got a mouth now. You can't apologize, you can't ask for forgiveness, you can't reform the words, you can't get it right this time, because you don't. All you there is as a consciousness, but you can't change it. That's the agony of it. Of course, in the deepest sense, what happens is the pain of re-experiencing that eventually fixes it up, and that's why you go through it. It's not just vindictive, it corrects it in the long run. But the point is, but every good thing you ever did, every time you overcame an instinct, and you overcame a temptation to be nasty, or whatever it was, and you said a kind word where it was needed, even though it cost you dearly, let's say, that washes over you again and again and again. It doesn't wash over you. It is you. And you experience it in an incremental, ecstatic way all the time. But what are you experiencing? You're not experiencing the fact that the sweat's over. You're experiencing the work that you put in. You're actually experiencing that. That means it doesn't make it, you follow. You can eat the fruit, you can eat the tree. It makes no difference. They both taste the same. It is the tree that brought out the fruit. It's the process that brought it out. And there you see that the process is the fruit. So the idea, what a person should concentrate on is this. What you're trying to work on Shabbos is this. You stop doing all building activities because you're trying to train yourself for the big Shabbos. You are trying to train yourself for the day when Friday night, yes, when the sun will finally go down, whenever it happens, and it won't come up again. And now what you didn't cook, you don't have. And you'll never be able to have. You need to emblazon that on your consciousness so strongly that you do it again every week, over and over and over. You need to train yourself what it means to work hard all week, accelerate that work to a crescendo. It's a mitzvah to run on Erev Shabbos. It's a mitzvah on Friday to run. It means to really put in, yes, as that crescendo approaches. And as the sun goes down, at that moment, you feel the snap of an experience between the work and what the result of the work feels like. And you also feel the fact that if you didn't do it, you can't do it now. What you didn't cook, you're not going to eat now. If you didn't switch on, you didn't light, you don't have it now. You need to feel that because you have to keep reinforcing, you know, because we've got such a powerful illusion of our own immortality that we don't think it's going to happen to us one day, that there'll be a transition from here to there. We don't think so. So it takes every 7 days to bash into your consciousness that one day there'll be a Shabbos that's what it'll be. And so you keep training yourself. The work stops and I can't do it now. So the next week you get the message, you work, you prepare. The mystics say that Shabbos is like a person who takes a sea voyage. If you didn't take with you out to sea, you don't have there. There's no way you can get it out there when you're in the middle of the ocean on a sailing ship. If you didn't take the provisions, you don't have it. If you didn't cook on Friday, if you didn't cook for Shabbos, you don't have it on Shabbos. You're supposed to feel that you're self-sufficient now, that you can't access input from any place else. That's what you're supposed to be building. That message and the pleasure of what it feels like not to need input from anywhere else. Because you put in the work beforehand. Let's take it one step further. It should be apparent now where the misconception of work and rest came in. You see, the misconception at a childish level, yes, and all those, even Jewish systems, unfortunately, they misunderstand the thing. The way they understand it is like as you work and then the work's over. The pleasure of the work being over is that now you rest. So Shabbos is a day you work all week and you need to have a rest. Practical. You need to rest to recharge. But nothing could be further from the truth. So understand. What are you exactly supposed to do on Shabbos? How do you do this? We said before that when you want to access a spiritual dimension, you use a physical tool. What's the physical tool that you use? You want to access a relationship with a human being, you need your body. There's no question, you need your body. You want to access Shabbos, you want to have a taste of what the world to come feels like. It says that Shabbos is a taste of 1/60th of the world to come. 1/60th, you can just taste what the next world feels like. Just the borderline of taste. Always 1 in 60 is the halachic minimum for, as I'm sure you're aware, if a little milk falls into a meat dish. So if it's less than 1 in 60, of course you're not allowed to do it deliberately, but if less than 1 in 60 falls in, it's kosher. Why? Because you can't taste one less than 1 in 60, generally speaking. And therefore, what it means when it says Shabbos is a 60th of the world to come, it means that it's on the borderline of what you can taste. That's what it means. If you don't put effort into it, so you won't taste it. But if you put effort, you could just raise yourself to the borderline of what you could actually taste in another dimension. But according to the work that you put in. What is the work? How do you get that taste? How do you get that taste of another dimension? So obviously, you get the taste by using the physical activities in such a way that you don't use the physical activities. Because the whole point of what you're trying to get it, should be clear, the whole point of what you're trying to get a taste of is the fact of what it feels like when you stop and you focus on what you have, not becoming but being. So what you do on Shabbos is you stop building and you experience what it feels like to have become. How do you do it? So you do it like this. You take those activities that build the world and you stop doing those things. Try and understand this. The laws of Shabbos are like this. It doesn't say any place you must rest. It says you must desist from 39 particular activities of creation. How do we learn it? Very interesting. It says like this. It says that the Mishkan, you know, the tabernacle, the sanctuary that was built in the desert by the Jews, it was built in a certain way, and the Torah describes all the activities needed to build it. And there were 39 categories of work that were needed to build it. There was dyeing the wool, and making things grow, and cutting to size, and lighting a fire, planting, plowing, reaping, 39 different, finally finishing a thing, the final hammer blow that finishes the thing, moving an object from one domain to another. There were 39 categories of not work at all, of creative activity that were needed to build this thing. In fact, the word in Hebrew is melacha. The Torah says that what's done here, the work we're talking about is melacha. That doesn't mean work at all. It doesn't mean work at all. The Hebrew word for work is avodah. The Torah doesn't say in any place that you have to not do avodah on Shabbos. which means desist from work, it says you're not allowed to do malocha. Malocha means an artisan or a craftsman's creative activity. That's what you can't do. It's the it doesn't matter how hard or easy it is. The pathetic anti-Semitic misconception is that it's got to do with how hard it is, because you must be resting from a hard activity. It's got nothing to do with it. It's got to do with whether this is a creative act or not. It doesn't matter how big or small. Can you feel how this fractured idea has crept in? Again, in those systems that we won't credit by using their names, let's say, if you argue with any of those people, they will tell you, for example, they will tell you, why don't we keep Shabbos anymore? You know what I'm talking about. They will tell you, why don't we keep Shabbos anymore the way you say? Because I'll tell you why. Because in the old days, listen to this logic, in the olden days, to switch on a light, why don't you switch on lights? Why do you Orthodox people? Why don't you switch on lights on Shabbos? I'll tell you, because what you're not allowed to do is work, right? And in the olden days, switching on a light was a lot of work. You had to rub two sticks together. You had to flick stones until they... Because a lot of manual effort. But today, it's flicking a switch. So since there's no work involved, can you hear the logic? I've got a completely putrid logic. And the idea behind it is this. It's got nothing to do with the work involved. It's got to do with the fact that making a fire, no matter how great or small the effort involved, is a creative activity. That's the point. It builds the world. It's a creative action. And that's what you're doing. Significantly, how hard or easy it is irrelevant over here. Completely side idea that you have a day where you actually physically raise. A completely ancillary idea. And therefore, you find it's got nothing to do with whether it's hard, old-fashioned or new-fashioned or a lot of work or not a lot. It's irrelevant that. The idea is whether you're doing a creative act. One match is a very creative activity. An enormous change in the world that can happen from one match. And therefore... Therefore, the reason we desist from these things, not because they're hard or easy, but because they, and of course from this simple analysis, you can see they're completely irrelevant to start analyzing the question from the point of view whether it's work or no work, they're completely irrelevant. The idea is whether it's a creative act that builds the world. So the Torah says this, there were 39 creative activities that were meant to build that tabernacle. Any beginner knows that the tabernacle, that Mishkan in the desert, was a microcosm of the universe. Inside there was a pattern that looked like the human body, by the placement of all its components, and that itself corresponds to the whole anatomy design of the universe, which means that the Kabbalistic sources, the Gemara itself learns this, that when they built that microcosm of the universe, they needed 39 creative activities. From that we understand that when Hashem created the world, when God created the universe originally, He must have used 39, the parallel of these 39 creative activities. That means that these are the 39 pathways. Why it's 39? Again, interesting. Not for now. These are the categories that were needed to create the world. How do we know to keep Shabbos? How do we know how you keep Shabbos? Remarkable. The Torah says like this. Build a Mishkan, and it describes how you build it, one malacha after another, and at the end of the list it says keep Shabbos. So the sages understood that the way you keep Shabbos is by stopping doing these 39. But after this evening's discussion, I hope it should be apparent how obvious that is. That's the idea. Therefore, so technically, how do you keep Shabbos? It's not by meditating. That's nice also. And resting. That might also be important. But the concept is that you work all week creatively. You build. You manhandle. You manipulate the world. You create it and reshape it. You put yourself into it and build it. And then on Shabbos, you snap out of that. You stop that. And you watch what's being built with the inability to touch it. So you are thoroughly training yourself for the day when you'll transition... From that, let's take this one step further. This gets a little frightening, but let's see if we can work it out. There are many parallels between the idea of Shabbos and the idea of the end of a person's life. Many parallels. I don't know if you're aware, many of the customs, it's a very strange thing. Many of the customs that we do before and during Shabbos, especially Friday as it goes into Shabbos, many of the customs are parallel to what happens when a person transitions from this world into the next. For example, we wash, people go to mikveh and wash, yes, they trim their nails, take a haircut, dress in white, Sfardim have a custom to dress in white, all the things we do to a person is not allowed. They get washed off. In some communities, they put in a mikveh. Their nails are trimmed, dressed in white. What's the idea? Obviously, the idea is that a voyage is about to begin. in which nothing more can be done, in which the purity of what's been built is what will be experienced. So we remind ourselves, remarkable thing, Shabbos, the happiest day, we do things that have a symbolism that are connected with the ultimate transition, because that's what you're supposed to be. If you take it even further, this is what gets a bit frightening, is this. So you can try and express this. How do you look in the next world? To understand this. How does a person look in the next world? What do they look like? What do you experience in the next world? The sum total of your... Not easy to understand this. What does a person look like spiritually in the next world? So the sources that talk about it say the following thing. Certain Hasidic sources, they say this. What a person looks like in the next world is the way they looked in the... It's a frightening idea. Let's say a person lived his whole life perfectly. In the last few seconds he makes a terrible mess. Terrible. Let's say in the last few seconds he loses his faith. And he ends up doing something terrible, a certain crime, a certain sin, he loses his connection with it. That's how it'll be forever. On the other hand, if a person doesn't work on himself all his lifetime, in the last few seconds, he comes right, and he generates tremendous spiritual consciousness, and he lifts himself to a level. Not easy in the last few seconds, but let's say he does it, complete yuva, so then he lives in perfection. Not easy. Not easy to do a lifetime's work equivalent in a few seconds, but can be done. Now why is this so? Why is this so? Let's see if we can try and pinpoint it. Why it is, how it works, and how we can connect it, how we understand this from Shabbos, and how we work on this. Are you prepared to talk about this? Not, yes? Not offended if you... It's too frightening. We talk about it because you have to be prepared. Right? A person has to assume that someday or other, the big Shabbos will come, right? And a person has to be prepared. And the only way to get to it successfully is to know about it. Of course, no one will be stressed beyond their level of ability to cope, but to that level, a person will be tested. So the sources say the following thing. I once had a Sephardi Rebbe who illustrated it in the following way. He said this, beautiful illustration, I didn't understand it fully at the time. He said that life is like an hour's pottery class. Yes, they give you a piece of clay, and for an hour you have to make the clay beautiful. At the end of the hour, everybody's clay gets put on the conveyor belt and it goes into the kiln. And in the kiln it gets fired. And once the clay is fired, you can't shape it anymore. So if you spend the hour making something beautiful, and it goes in and gets fired, it will forever be that way. It can never be changed. On the other hand, if you spend the hour making a very beautiful object, and in the last second you scrunch it into a shapeless, it will be fired that way. It will not reflect. It will not reflect the work that went into it. All the care and work that went into it, all the beauty, won't be reflected because, on the other hand, if you spent the hour not putting effort into making that, and the last few seconds you suddenly panicked, and you made something beautiful that's very hard in the last few seconds. Very hard. Making something beautiful takes time. Takes work and practice and learning from mistakes. But if you manage to scramble something together, in the last few seconds, you'll be fine that way. That's how it is that a person, yes, transitions into the next world. It's how you look at the last second. The idea, so I'm going to take it a little further, the idea is like this. It's a very frightening idea, but there is an idea like this. The last second, again, the last second, you realize here we're talking about life, this world to the next. We're talking about Shabbos, but we're talking about every crisis. We're talking about any transition between phases, any transition in life. Yes, any transition between phases, when something happens to a person, and he assesses the past, and he has to, or she has to move into the future. So at that phase of transition, what's critical is the phase of joining. That means it's the exact instant of interface between the previous phase and the next phase that will determine how you'll be forever. Again, you hear that? When you enter something, the way you make a bond of a covenant between you and somebody else, the intensity with which it's done will never let you down. If there's a fracture there, then it will definitely come out. The way a child is conceived, again, the way a child is conceived, he'll definitely look that way. In the moment of conception, when the genes lock into each other, and the genes of the child are formed, no matter what you do, the child will look that way. No matter how many months down the line it will take till the child is formed, and no matter what illnesses, God forbid, or whatever it is that will come out many years later, they were coded for at that instant. It must be like that. Are we together? The child... Now... Which means that's where the effort should go. That's the big ordeal. in any crisis, in any transition. A crisis is a transition between the lower self of what you were before you went through this pressure and how you've come out of it afterwards, successfully, building yourself to the new level. It's in the moment of crisis, the moment of transition between that world and the next, which is what you are, and that's what you'll always be. You see this very strongly. There are many times that it says that a moment of acute transition, a person's forgiven all his sins. What does that mean? It means a completely new beginning. For example, a marriage. It says when you stand under the chuppah the day of your wedding and you're fasting, so that's a complete, you've completely forgiven, the past disappears? Yes, because, you follow, at the phase, a person who converts to Judaism. Person who converts. It's a completely newborn, completely reborn individual. And there are other experiences also. But of course, if it's going to have all that power, it has to be enormously electric. That means there has to be a potency at that moment of connection. When Shabbos, when Friday becomes Shabbos, at that moment, there has to be an electricity of the meeting of two opposites, of the dissolution of what you were before, and the forming of what you now become, that has to be very, very potent, and therefore very dangerous. If you want a lot of electricity, the mystics always say in their own terms, that if you want a lot of electricity, so with a lot of electricity you can do fantastic things, but if you make a misstep, it'll fry you. If you're working with high tension lines, so you can power a town with high tension current. But if you misconnect with it, so then the consequences are disastrous. That's what happens at the electric moment of a climax where the voltage is stepped up. So the mystics explain, if you could just begin to try and grasp this, the mystics explain that the way the neshama feels that is like this. I'm trying to explain it as calmly as I can. When a person passes from this world to the next, the ultimate ordeal awaits them. That means the final ordeal. Life is a series of ordeals, but the final ordeal is the ordeal of transitioning from this zone to the next. What's the ordeal? The ordeal is like this. The ordeal is an ordeal of faith. It's an ordeal of emunah. Always the last ordeal. The final ordeal is an ordeal of faith, where a person's intellect is paralyzed, where the logical pathway ceases. And the only way you can push through this phase is if you believe. That means, belief in Torah means loyalty. Yes, it doesn't mean bamboozled into a zombie-like sort of acceptance, hypnotic, it's got nothing to do with that. It means loyalty to what you knew once was correct, even though now it's not reflecting itself as correct, but you trusted yourself to it once and you staked your life on it, and now that you gave your life to it in loyalty to this person, or this relationship, or whatever it was, especially if you're the kind of person who has as one of their strongest characteristics loyalty, then what happens is the final ordeal will be an ordeal where you'll be tested in such a way that logically it won't look correct. Logically it won't look correct. But what will happen is you'll be expected to hold strong even though it doesn't look correct. Let me try and make it much clearer. Where do we see this? In the sources that talk about it, they always talk about the birth of a child. The birth of a child doesn't look logical at all. The pregnancy progresses according to a logical sequence that gets a little bit more of the same every day. But the final event when a woman goes into labor doesn't look anything like the previous experience. It doesn't look like a life-giving experience at all. It looks like a death experience. Yes, it looks dangerous. It's painful and dangerous. Anybody's never seen it before. If anybody, can you imagine? You see, we're so used to it, we don't think about it this way. But give yourself an unclouded consciousness. Imagine you were with a woman, or imagine you were the woman herself, who didn't know what labor was all about. Can you imagine that? Imagine going through a pregnancy. Yes, day after day, and suddenly going into labor. Can you imagine? Definitely you'd think you were dying. There's no question about it. And anybody watching would definitely think it looks like an abysmal experience. It looks like a horrendous death. But that death experience is what brings a new life into the world. That's always the final ordeal, that the logical pathway transitions from what looks like a progress and a logic, and suddenly snaps around, and that's the test. Of course, preparation helps. I'm sure you're racing ahead of me. The messianic birth, when the Mashiach appears in the world, will be preceded by a war so awesome and by ordeal so terrible for the Jewish people that there'll be proofs that we're wrong. You're aware of this. There'll be Drashim that say that the final ordeal will be that the Arab peoples will come against the Jews. You're aware of that. The prediction, the Ramban says clearly, that the Arabs will get together with the entire Western bloc of nations, or at least many of them, and all come against the Jewish people. There'll be some war that. The Gaon says that the war will take 12 minutes only. The Gaon writing 200 years ago. Now, and what will be the final test? What will be the final event? Unless we can prevent it, of course. You can do it ourselves. The rapid cesarean section now. We can prevent the whole thing. If we don't do it, What will happen? The final test that will merit us to bring that messianic thing, to bring the love between Hashem and us so close that it manifests in the world. The only test of love is when it doesn't look... When two people commit themselves to each other and they stay, they remain loyal and faithful to each other when everything's going well and that's what should be done, that's no test of their love. That's not, it doesn't prove the love, it doesn't bring it out. You follow? When everything's convenient and progressing according to plan. So it's convenient and it's pleasant, but there's, the love hasn't been manifest. The way the love is manifest is where each one thinks the worst about the other. The information that you're getting, all the external signs, all the logic of the whole situation is completely a go, flies in the face of logic. That's when loyalty is being tested. So it says that when the nations come against us, it says the final event will be, the final event will be, it says quite plainly, the Medrash says that the Arabs will say to the Jews, the Jews, it says, the leaders of the Jews will say to the Arab people, amazing Medrash, written who knows how long ago, that the Jews will say to the Arabs, remove your holy place from our mountain. That's what it says. Long before that thing was built. There'll be a holy place, and the Jews will say, the Arabs will say, no, it's ours. And before crisis develops, it says that the Bnei Ishmael, the sons of Ishmael, they say to the Jews, let's not fight, let's make a test. Let's go up and build an altar in that place, and you build an altar. We'll build an altar, you build it. You bring an animal on your sacrifice, and we'll bring a sacrifice, just like in the days of Eliyahu, of Elijah. You bring a sacrifice, we'll bring one. And let's see which one Hashem accepts. And it says the Jews agree. And they build an altar, and they build an altar, and the Arabs, but they make a deal. They make a deal that whichever one is shown favor from the transcendent plane will all follow that. Yes, we'll all follow that system. That means if Hashem shows favor for our sacrifice, like used to happen in days of old when a fire came from heaven, then we all become, all follow the Torah. And they all agree. And they march up, and they build a Mizbeach, and they do, and they put a korban, and fire comes from heaven for the Arabs' offering. That's what it says. And at that moment it says, the B'nai Ishmael turn to the Jewish people, and they say, we had a deal, you have to join us. And at that moment the Jews say, never, and they all shout, Shema Israel, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, and there's a terrible battle, and those who survive flee to the desert, and after 40 days of hiding in the desert, the Mashiach appears. That's what it says. The Medrash says that. Now, I've heard from very great people that that pathway is 100% accurate. Whether the details will be like that, probably not, because we have a deep tradition that one of the aspects of the Messianic revelation will be surprise, which means that it can't happen in a pathway that's divine. And if it does start that way, that will be a cause for terror, because there must be a surprise. That means it cannot go, you follow. So don't ask me what it will be. But the elements will be that way. That means there will be a cruel proof that we're wrong. But how else are you going to be tested? You follow? If we're marching with Hashem all the time, and our side is always represented, and we see ourselves to be clearly correct, well, who's being tested here? You follow? That's not a proof of love. There will be a final ordeal, definitely, which is an ordeal that stresses you into remaining loyal when it seems impossible. That's a test of loyalty. Now, how does this work in our Shabbos story? It says this, that when a person transitions from this world to the next, which is exactly a birth, that's exactly a birth process. The Rambam writes clearly that when a woman gives birth, it looks like she's dying, and the child looks like it's dying. We've been through this before, as I'm sure many of you remember. The Rambam explains how all the physiology and anatomy of a child reverses itself as he's born. It looks like he's dying on the outside. He can't live out there without the connection to his mother, without lungs, without blood going through. Everything's all wrong. And in 3 minutes, it all reverses itself. What happens is that when a person transitions from this world to the next, what happens is the final ordeal is an ordeal of Emunah. What happens is this. This is learned from a Gemara. The Gemara says, very interesting, the Gemara is talking about the obligations of a worker. The Gemara says when a person hires a worker, a remarkable thing, it brings verses in Tehillim, Psalms, to prove that when a man hires a worker, when you hire an employee, he has to work for you until the sun goes down. He has to work till the sun goes down, that's what it says. Till the sun goes down. That means you can't force him, you follow. The problem in the Gemara, I'm not going to go into Halacha here, but the problem is, on whose time does he have to spend going home, yours or his? If he travels far to get home, on whose time is it? Interesting question, Halacha. So the Gemara says this, it's on his time at night and on yours in the morning. Yes? On the morning, he doesn't have to leave home before dawn. He travels to work on your time. But he has to work till the night, till the sun goes down. It's an amazing thing. He has to work till the sun goes down and travel home in the dark on his account. You follow? That's how it works. Unless it's agreed otherwise. But if it's not agreed, that's the Halacha. So the Gemara goes on to a sidetrack and it says this. You know what this really means? It doesn't only mean that when you employ an employee, he has to work for you till the sun goes down and then he's on his own time. It means that when you are the employee and you're working for Hashem and your sun goes down, you hear? You have to work until the sun goes down. What's it mean? You can't slack off a minute before. You have to work until the sun goes down. You travel home on your time. You follow? You have to work until the job's... I mean, until the sun... So the Gemara says like this. The Hasidic sources say the following idea. What does it mean until the sun goes down? It means until the sun goes down. Not until it's going down, until it goes down. That means until it's down. What does that mean? It means you have to work until it's down. What does that mean? You have to work in the darkness. Listen to this. That infinite phase, that infinitely thin phase, which is the joining between two, whose obligation is that? That's yours. Listen carefully. What happens? It says this. A person leaves this world. They leave. They start channeling themselves through some kind of mystical tunnel. And in that phase, there's a zone. By the way, this has been described. Many people have entered that zone, so-called, and they have come back and they've described. Very interesting, because the non-Jews have been through this. My research work, are you probably aware, research work has been done on this. They describe the same experiences that the Gemara describes. Certain mystical things that happen. But what happens is this, that in that zone of interface, of transition between this existence and the next, this existence does not meet the next directly. There is an intermediate phase. And what is that? Nothingness. You hear that? The first thing that the neshama experiences, when a person thinks that their body is finally not used anymore, the neshama leaves, that instantaneously it reaches... No, it doesn't happen like that. What happens is this. The neshama leaves, but it doesn't instantaneously reach another place. It first enters a holding point where there's complete and utter nothingness and blackness. And in that moment, in that instant of complete blackness, the Yetzer Hara comes to a person, your own lower self, your own, yes, your own negative drive, your own loneliness, and says to you, see, I told you there's nothing here. Look around you. And if a person lets go in that instant, they lose everything. And it seems, it's proof, person's left, they're not here anymore, body doesn't operate, they've moved on, and there's nothing. The final test is always a test of emunah. Are you going to hold strong in that phase? Again, nobody's tested, obviously, to a level that they're not capable of dealing with. Obviously, obviously. But that's what it is. Where do we see this? Where do we see this in Shabbos? How do you see this transition? How do we learn that? We said before, the whole idea we're discussing this evening is that the experience of Shabbos is an opportunity to learn what you need to learn about the next world. Where do you learn this? We'll finish with this idea. You learn it, more or less. You still got another few minutes concentration. We learn like this. You able to concentrate for another couple of minutes? We have an idea like this. What did we just say? We said that the critical moment is that last moment. Everything is defined by that last moment. How do we see it in Shabbos? Remarkable thing. Do you know that the laws of Shabbos, don't try to show, all I'm trying to do is show the depth, yes? What idiots think is a day of rest that you're supposed to collapse and regenerate, you know, like an animal, trying to show that every nuance of every halacha here, not striking a match or whatever it is, even the way you cover the challahs with a cloth, whatever it is that you do, each detail is connected to the higher spiritual sources. Do you know that the laws of Shabbos take their tone, they take their definition from when? From the instant that Shabbos comes in. Do you know that? Let me give you an example. Just give you one example. There's a law called Muktzah. Do you know what Muktzah is? Muktzah is a law that you're not allowed to move things that are forbidden to use on Shabbos. Let's say, for example, you're not allowed to use money on Shabbos, right? You can't buy. So therefore, money is muktzah. You cannot handle it. Cannot move it. Or, for example, you can't write on Shabbos. So therefore, a pen or a pencil is muktzah. Not only can't you write, but there's an additional law that you can't even handle it or move it. Now, what defines an object's status as muktzah? It's a very interesting question. You know what defines it? Listen carefully. Let me give you an example. Let's say, for example, a table. Table's not muktzah, you can move a table on Shabbos. But if the table is a support for something that's muktzah, then the table's muktzah also. Let's say you have a little table and you have money on it. You see? Or candles or a pen, things that you can't move. The law is that the table also becomes muktzah, cannot move it anymore. Now the question is, what happens if on Shabbos the candles are removed? Or the pen or the money is removed? You know what the law is? You still can't move the table. You know why? Because at the instant the sun went down, it was muktzah and it can never change. You hear that? You hear that? Even though the table's an ordinary table now. Had it been that it was an ordinary table the whole day, you could have moved it. But since the instant that Shabbos came in, at that infinitely thin interface between Friday and Shabbos, at that instant it was forbidden. So even if you change it, try as you may, and you try and bash it into a shape that looks permitted, you can't change its status. You follow? You hear that? You hear that? Beautiful thing. Again, a simple halachic idea that we understand from that a tremendous depth in the same thing that we've been talking about all along. What did we learn? We learned that there's a pleasure, an ecstasy, which is the pleasure of finishing something that has to be finished. The pleasure that you feel when the thing's finished is the pleasure of the thing that you did, not the fact that you stopped doing it. And that's just a torture. A person who undergoes torture, they long for the time when the torture will stop. But the life isn't a torture. Life shouldn't be. Life should be an experience where what you long for is the pleasure of experiencing what you've been building all the time. And that's what it is. That experience of stopping work, right? What's all this connected to vocation? Where everything we talk about should be connected to what we're doing, right? What's this connected to vocation, which is to the places that say that if you want to have a faint taste of this, faint taste of this idea, it's the experience you have as you begin a vocation, as you begin a holiday. Yes? What is the pleasure? Think about it. Analyze. What exactly is the pleasure of locking up? Yes, think about it carefully. Shouldn't be too far away. Right? What exactly is the pleasure of a vacation? You know what it is? It's the first instant. It's the anticipation. It's the moment that the work stops and suddenly you're released. Yes? It's the experience of release. Half an hour after that, it's all over. It disappears. Yes? You're anxious to get back to whatever, to your borders, anything. But it's the moment that you're released, that suddenly the spring has been released. What happens now is that the work has suddenly given vent. That moment, right, is an incredible experience. People feel it sometimes most strongly, let's say when they leave a torturous situation, like let's say leaving school. People leave school after 12 years of misery sometimes. What happens is an unbelievable feeling. What exactly is the pleasure? What exactly is the pleasure? You don't do anything yet. What's the pleasure? What does a child feel on Friday when the bell rings? What pleasure did you just get? Nothing happened. You didn't get anything new. You didn't do anything yet. What happened is that you follow. And that's why in Torah, when a person dies, lo aleinu, it's called patira. You know that we say somebody's nifta. We don't say in Hebrew somebody dies. We say they're nifta. Nifta means they become absolved of their responsibilities. Is what it means. Absolved. It means they become what do you call it? Potter. They become freed of their obligations. The job, the tools are laid down, and time's called. Yeah, you become, that's what it is. It means this is a process where you geared in, you yoked, harnessed into obligation. The instant that it's over, that's nifta. That means the obligation's lifted. The ecstasy, yes, is the ecstasy of having been released. But the depth of it is the ecstasy of having been released and now to be able to face the long hours and years of work that you put in that now are what you are. Finally, let's say this. Where can you actually taste this in the world? Where do you taste it? So we have a very remarkable idea. Let's try and finish with this, promise you. Ideas like this. If everything is justified by its endpoint, so what exactly is the endpoint? So we have a very, very deep idea that everything that is represented in a spiritual world can be tasted here. Can be experienced here. Which means this. Life leads towards an endpoint, which is the next world. I can't see that here. So where do I feel it? So we have the following idea. We have two places where you can feel it. One is an exercise where you build it, and that's called Shabbos. So that's an exercise. You're supposed to get the message that one day there will be a big Shabbos. You won't be able to work for it. And therefore you have to build now in order to... So that's Shabbos you work on. Where do you actually feel it? Where do you actually feel it? In what's called learning Torah. Torah is the one thing in the world that's an end in itself. Do you know that? If a person wants to get, even Shabbos in a way, is not an end in itself. You know why? Because you're doing Shabbos partially in order to explore and experience what it's going to feel like to live through an experience of building and then not being able to build. So you're training yourself every Shabbos. You're actually sitting down on Shabbos and experiencing what it feels like to transition from where you can work to what you can't. And it's a learning experience. But the learning experience of Torah, the mystics say, is the one experience that there is in the world, the only experience that there is, the only experience that's an end in itself. That's why we don't learn Torah in order to be able to do something with it. We do that also. But there's another dimension of Torah learning that a person does only because he's doing it. There has to be that. There has to be. Because if there isn't that in the world, so again, you never have an opportunity to experience something that's an endpoint. Which means and that's why it says, that's one of the reasons why it says that Torah is connected or equal to all other mitzvahs. Because it's the one area, where a person can get into that thing and actually feel that he's arrived home. There is a side of marriage which is also not appropriate to discuss here, where a person can experience it. But Torah learning is, we did discuss it once, if you want to go into detail, there's a cassette, I think it's called Sensuality and Responsibility, I forget, but you can find such a cassette. That's what it is. Torah learning is the final experience of an endpoint. Shabbos is the training experience that a person does in order to learn how to do that. And that's why, that's the idea, that's the reason, that's the basic reason why we spend so much time doing that. Why we spend, what we started off in the beginning, asking why is it necessary that once every 7 days we have to go through this. The answer is, and it should be plain, I hope, that the idea, the ultimate, the justification for life is what a person's built. And if you're going through, dragging on from one day to the next, hoping that today just won't be worse than yesterday, so that's not the way to live. A person has to reassess all the time where they're going. And Shabbos is the opportunity to reassess and get a taste of what's called the next world. And that's, we can just live on that borderline. 1/60th of a taste. We get 1/60th of an experience of what the next world is. And that's what it means Shabbos is Ma'en Olam Haba.